January 16th, 1987 was a typical day when the Botany Bay Flower Shop was beginning to open. It was just a few minutes before 8 a.m. Randall Benson, who had only been working there for a month in Atlanta, was opening the shop up, eager to please the boss. And like normal, Randall turned on the lights, unlocked the front door, and then he went to the back of the store to bring the cash register to the front. During the nights, they hid the register in the cooler so that no one could find it. And he was surprised when he heard the sliding door open. It was almost as if the customer was waiting outside, which came off as a surprise, because rarely did the flower shop have anyone waiting on him to open the door in the morning. And not to mention, he still hadn't finished his morning routine of opening up the shop. Today, we are continuing the story from last week about the tragic death of Lita McClinton, an African-American Atlanta socialite who met her death when she opened her door at her Atlanta townhouse in the early morning hours to a flower delivery man, or at least someone she thought was a flower delivery man. Fueled by greed and an unchecked ego, Jim Sullivan's desire for control didn't end with divorce papers. He wanted Lita erased. But how did he pull off a murder from another state? And how did investigators finally unravel the tangled web of deception? This is part two of Stolen Betrayal, the life and tragedy of Lita McClinton. We're about to dive into the twisted motives, the hired hitman, and the decades-long pursuit of justice for a woman who deserved so much more. And look, we know we said in part one that this would be the final episode, but there's just too many what the F's in this case to cram it into a two-parter, so buckle up because we've got one more episode after this.
It's a wild ride.
I'm Ashley.
And I'm Ricky.
And this is Crime Salad.
Let's recap.
Let's do it. So in part one, we uncovered Lita's life and her doomed marriage to the arrogant, selfish Jim Sullivan, a union destined for chaos. And where we left off, Lita was at a point in the marriage where she felt like she had to break free. Enough was enough. Even though the divorce was against her beliefs, she was pretty set on ending the marriage. And I think we painted a relatively clear picture that Jim wasn't the kind of man who let go easily, at least if it wasn't his decision. And as you can understand, their divorce wasn't just messy. It was ruthless. Lita McClinton Sullivan filed for divorce from James Sullivan in August of 1985. And the divorce proceedings were contentious, particularly regarding the validity of a post-nuptial agreement between them. If they divorced, this would leave Jim still in control over all other assets and properties, which, you know, Jim Sullivan, he had inherited a lucrative wholesale liquor distribution business, which was because of the mysterious death of his uncle Frank. And recently, he turned around and he sold the business for $5 million. And he owned a few properties, too, including the mansion in Palm Beach, Florida, and also the townhouse that Lita lived in Atlanta, Georgia, and a few expensive things, including a Rolls Royce.
Okay, so the post-nup agreement was $300 a month and then $30,000 annually for 3 years, right?
Yeah.
Wow, so $300 a month, that is like nothing for him. So what did Lita want out of this divorce? Because she couldn't have been happy with that.
No. So during the divorce proceedings, Lita McClinton Sullivan, she sought a more substantial financial settlement than what was outlined in the postnuptial agreement. Initially, a court granted her $7,000 per month in temporary alimony. However, James Sullivan successfully petitioned to reduce the amount to $2,500 per month. And Lita was dissatisfied with this reduction. She pursued an even larger settlement, including ownership of the Atlanta townhouse, one of their Mercedes vehicles, and $200,000 in cash. These demands were central to the contentious nature of their divorce proceedings. The tension between Lita and Jim reached a breaking point, and soon it would spiral into something far more dangerous than anyone could ever imagine. That morning, on January 16th, 1987, Lita was in bed with her thoughts, and she probably was thinking about the hearing that was supposed to happen later that day. It was the hearing where their postnuptial agreement would be decided, and her attorneys told her that the jury would most likely decide in her favor. This probably pleased Lita, but what she probably wanted most of all was just to end the nightmare of a marriage. She was exhausted of all the things that her soon-to ex-husband had put her through.
Well, even in the marriage, she was given an allowance and kept on a leash. Not to mention he had multiple affairs. I mean, this dude literally only cares about himself.
Exactly. Lita had been living in hell. And if you remember, Jim, he actually would hide his marriage with Lita from a lot of people, like people he worked with, his family even. And so on this day, Lita, she was very hopeful for this marriage to end, and she could finally get a fair amount of alimony. Meanwhile, back at the Botany Bay flower shop, Randall greeted his first customer of the day, and he noticed a white Toyota parked in the parking bay in front of the store. And the car had North Carolina license plates, which is kind of odd since the story takes place in Atlanta, Georgia. And so the man who came in the store was wearing a flannel shirt, which he had paired with work pants. This guy walked in the store and he didn't look like the typical customer who Randall would see. And for some reason, Randall just got this weird feeling. His typical clients were businessmen who would usually stop by the flower shop to buy flowers for their secretaries, or maybe they were husbands who were dressed in business attire, coming in before or after work, purchasing bouquets as an apology gift for an argument that had gone awry. This man, though, he basically stood out from the usual, wearing his flannel shirt and work pants. Randall would later tell detectives that the customer seemed to be around his mid-30s. He was almost 6 feet tall, and he had curly hair, and seemed to have trouble growing a beard. But what I think added to the unusualness of it all is he was so impatient and rude. He just wanted to purchase some roses and leave. He didn't care what the roses looked like or how they were packaged. And there was his accent. Randall had grown up in Georgia, and the client's accent was not from Georgia. And when he came into the shop, he immediately demanded at Randall, "Give me a dozen roses."
I don't know. If I was in Randall's position, I'd think I was getting robbed.
Yeah, and that's what he was thinking too. I mean, this is a flower shop, not like a bar or something. Anyways, Randall served this strange, unusual customer, asking the client what color he wanted for the roses. And the client snarled again, "Don't care." Randall tried to get clear instructions, like why was this client purchasing the roses? Was it for a birthday, a graduation, just a gift? He explained to the client, if the roses were for your wife or your girlfriend, you would want red. If it's for an anniversary, you would want to get yellow roses.
Yellow for anniversary?
Mm-hmm.
I thought you just get red roses for everything.
No, Ricky, those things matter. But to Randall, he seemed like he was in a hurry. He didn't care what roses he got. And to Randall, he described him as if he were an angry dog showing his teeth, growling. "Don't matter. Just give me a dozen roses." And Randall tried again. He just wanted clearer instructions. He showed the client the selection of roses that they had in the store. This time, the client almost yelled. And if the client didn't want to be remembered purchasing roses, he was doing a poor job of it. He told Randall, "I don't care what they're like, and I haven't got much time." He seemed about ready to jump over the counter and grab the roses himself. Randall just picked up 12 pink roses, and he questioned the client again, "Would you like them in a box or in water?" This time the client replied with two words, "A box."
God dang, I'm getting flashbacks to working in retail.
Exactly. And poor Randall, he's just trying to do his best. And he continued to take his time. He started sticking wires into the roses' heads to keep them from drooping, but the client wasn't happy with Randall's thoroughness. "You don't have to do that," he barked. Again, Randall tried to explain. He said, "Well, if I don't, they're not going to hold, you know, hold up." The client knew nobody would care if the roses drooped as soon as he shot his gun. It's not a problem, he roared.
Wow, so barked, growled, and roared. This guy's a real animal.
Well, you know what I mean. Randall instantly obeyed. Only 5 of the flowers had been secured with wire, and Randall, he didn't do the other 7. He just placed all pink flowers in a long white box, then he tied the box with a pink satin ribbon. When Randall began to stick on a decorative sticker with the store's name and address, the man stopped him. The man didn't respond when Randall asked him, "Do you want a card?" He only searched his pockets, looking for change. And when he didn't find the $25 needed to purchase the roses, he went and spoke with the other passenger in the white Toyota, the one with the North Carolina plates. Randall couldn't see a lot of the passenger, but he could tell the passenger was male. When the rude client asked the Toyota passenger for money, the passenger started searching for the cash through what it seemed to Randall to be rolled up sleeping bags. The rude client returned with the $25, which he threw on the counter, and then he left without saying a word. The rude client didn't even ask for a receipt.
Way to stay under the radar.
And Randall probably thought this was the most unsettling and strangest encounter he had with a customer, if he only knew what was on this client's mind.
But why go to a florist? Like, you're knocking on a door. You could have got flowers from a grocery store or something.
Yeah, seems kind of weird. Maybe he was just following orders from the boss. So after buying the pink roses, his next destination was Lita McClinton's Atlanta townhouse located at 3085 Slayton Avenue. The townhouse was located in Atlanta's Buckhead, an uptown and residential district of Georgia's capital city. It was 8:15 in the morning when Lita heard the doorbell ring. She opened the window to see who was at the door, and she saw someone with thinning hair holding a flower box under his left arm. She probably thought it was odd. I mean, she had no idea who would be sending her flowers. It definitely wouldn't have been Jim. He was past the point of wanting to apologize to her. In fact, he probably wanted her dead. The man at the door responded. "Flower delivery, ma'am," he said. Lita replied from the window. "Okay, I'll be right down." She unlocks the door, and as she opens the door, the delivery man said, "You need to sign for them." Lita allowed the man to enter her townhouse. "Come in," she told the delivery man, not realizing the danger that she was in. "I'll find a pen." The fake delivery man followed Lita inside and walked into the foyer. The door was partially closed behind him. The fake delivery man pulled out his gun and started firing. The first bullet fired missed Lita, ripping through a curtain in the dining room, and then it continued through the French windows. In a shocking realization, Lita, who's holding the flower box, desperately shielded her face. Another shot is fired, shooting through the flimsy cardboard flower box, directly entering the left side of her head near her temple and exiting through her right ear. Lita's body crumples to the ground, and the third bullet was shot by her as she fell.
Damn. I'm assuming someone heard something, though, because this is a townhouse for one, but also a pretty nice neighborhood. They didn't have Facebook, but dang, if they had Facebook, they'd be like, "I think I heard fireworks or a gunshot."
Yeah, well, a neighbor of Lita's, Bob Christensen, watches as the fake delivery man runs away. And he tries to get away as fast as he can. He's running. His feet are actually slipping sideways on the asphalt, which is slick from an earlier downpour. Bob wants to chase after the man, but he heard the gunshots. He was a combat soldier in Vietnam. For a few seconds, he weighed his options: chase the murderer or check on Lita. He knew she was seriously injured, and her life mattered more than a pursuit. Besides, the shooter was armed and dangerous. Without hesitation, he rushed to her side, hoping there was still something he could do.
What did he find?
So when Bob arrived, he found the door was a little bit open, and so he steps inside, and he sees Lita's body on the floor. There in the middle of the marble floor is Lita lying face up in a white robe. And there's blood pooling beneath her head and a gunshot wound on the left side of her face. He kneels down beside her and realizes she's still breathing. He dashes up, runs in the kitchen, grabs the phone, and dials 911. Then he brings a hand towel and lays it underneath Lita's head. next to Lita, 6 feet away, is the unopened box of pink roses with blood spatter covering it. He would later describe the day at the Sullivan's trial. I have some military training, and though I'm no medic or anything like that, you do know some things you're supposed to do for trauma victims. So I looked to see if she was still breathing. She was. Not well, but she was still breathing, and she seemed to be unconscious. It looked to me as if she had been shot in the face. I knelt down beside her, opened her mouth to see if she had swallowed her tongue, and put my hands, underneath her head to see if I could find any wounds. Then I could see there wasn't a whole lot I could do for Lita. I called 911. And Bob was not the only one actually in this townhouse. Poppy, Lita's close friend from college, was upstairs. She had stayed over through the night with her daughter, Ingrid.
God, that's terrifying.
And she was terrified. With the three gunshots going off, in a panic, she pulled her daughter, Ingrid, out of bed, dragged her into a closet, and she covered Ingrid with a blanket and nervously whispered in her ear, "Be quiet, quiet as a mouse." Poppy stays with her daughter in the closet, not knowing if the intruder was going to come up the stairs. And she's terrified. She hugs her daughter close to her to protect her from any danger that could be coming. There was also another neighbor, Homer Deakins Jr., who had heard the three shots, and he described his memory of the shooting. "I was on the sofa in my breakfast room facing away from Lita's house when I heard two noises," he said. "They sounded like steel hitting steel, and I saw this guy running out of the neighborhood. I saw that Lita's door was open, and I didn't go out immediately. I waited a couple minutes, then I walked over to Lita's porch, looked inside, and I saw her lying there. I didn't go in. I backed out and met Bob Christensen. He had already called the police."
Well, going off what you said about the flower shop, these two, the guy who bought the flowers and the guy who was in the car, they really didn't try to hide their identity at all. And then as for the timing, this was like 8 a.m. So, I mean, firing shots off at 8 a.m. in the morning, like, that's suspicious.
Yeah, anyone could have easily saw him, you know. And Deakins, the other neighbor, he did have a good description. He told the police, "The guy I saw at the door was tall, at least 6 feet. I would say that he was in his 50s. He had a receding hairline. His hair was brown, but light. And he wore glasses. I thought they were steel glasses that looked more like aviator glasses." His description went on to say that he had on a light jacket and was kind of shabby. He certainly didn't look like a business person.
Yeah, like I said, they made a very memorable interaction. So I would hope that the people involved at least had a good description, at least enough to get the police involved.
Buckhead Officer Ebert Thrau with the Atlanta Police Department, he was the first to arrive at the scene, and he drove alone in his police car when the dispatcher calls through the radio a signal 50. In Atlanta, a signal 50 indicated someone had been shot, and thankfully he wasn't that far away and only took him about 2 minutes to get to Lita's townhouse. As he gets closer to the townhouse, he sees a man waving him down. It's the neighbor, Bob, desperate for the police to arrive. So Bob had been Lita's neighbor for a while, and he always saw himself as a protector of Lita, mainly because he knew that she lived alone, and he also knew that she was going through a messy divorce. When the officer stops the car, he follows Bob into Lita's brick townhouse. Bob's talking really fast, and the officer is having difficulties keeping track of what Bob is saying. He could understand a few words like delivery man, flowers, and gunshots. Then when he makes it into the hallway and finds Lita's body, she's barely alive, and there's swelling around the bullet wounds. He knows the ambulance is on their way, but there's not much the officer can do except wait. He gets on his knees beside Lita, and he holds her hand. He says in a calm voice repeatedly, "Hold on, it's okay, everything's okay. Hold on, just breathe." And she squeezes his hand. She was well aware that she had been shot, and it's horrible because she's suffering, really. Once the ambulance sirens were heard, Poppy, the friend upstairs, felt relieved, and she felt safe enough to go downstairs. She wanted to see if Lita is okay. Poppy quietly creeps towards the top of the staircase and stares down the stairs. She sees Lita's legs, and they're not moving. Officer Thrall sees her at the top of the stairs, and he's astonished to see that someone else is in the house. What are you doing up there? Not knowing if maybe she had something to do with the shooting.
So this was Poppy, right? I think she was staying the night with her daughter to support Lita.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which would be absolutely tragic and frightening. The officer asked her what happened. She's a little frightened to reply. He's the first person that she sees. For all she knows, he could be the shooter, even if he's a police officer. She's a little hesitant when she answers. I'm hiding with my daughter, she said. She then says in a soft and fearful voice, Is Lita okay? Officer Thrall then realizes that Poppy is not a suspect. She and her daughter are victims too. They had to live through a traumatic event. He answers in a sad tone. She's alive, barely.
Oh my God, I feel so bad for the daughter having to experience all of that. How terrifying.
Yeah, I know. And once Poppy spoke to Officer Thrall, she makes a call to Lita's mom. Lita's mom, Joanne, was actually getting ready to visit the hospital to visit her mom. And she got the unthinkable news. Poppy on the phone, she couldn't even get the words out. All she could do was sob. And through the sobs, she was able to get out, "It's Lita. It's Lita. Lita's been shot." Lita's mom didn't understand what was happening. She couldn't really understand what Poppy was saying through her sobs. And when she hears that her daughter has been shot, Joanne yells into the phone, "What? What's happening?" However, Poppy was crying too much. She couldn't say much of anything else. She hangs up with Poppy and calls her husband, Emery Sr. She snatches her purse and her keys. She gets into her car to drive to Lita's home. And Emery Sr. is also en route too. During the drive, Joanne wonders what occurred. She's thinking maybe it was a robbery. She wonders maybe someone shot her daughter in the arm or the leg. But when Joanne arrived at Lita's house, the ambulance was already on their way to the hospital with Lita inside. Emery Sr. had arrived before her and was already following the ambulance. They drove to Piedmont Hospital, which was the same hospital where Lita was born. The ambulance arrived at the hospital at 9:11 a.m., almost an hour after the fake delivery man rang Lita's doorbell. At 9:39 a.m., Joanne and Emery Sr. received the bad news. The doctor starts out with, "I'm sorry." That's all Joanne hears.
And that's the worst news that you can possibly get as a parent.
Yeah, I mean, their baby just died, and you don't even know what happened. When they heard the news, Emery Sr., he knew immediately who the murderer was. He said, "It was that son of a bitch, Jim Sullivan." They, Emery Sr. and Joanne, they knew from the start that Jim Sullivan was trouble. They thought of the past, reviewed the events in their minds, and thought of the different ways they could have kept Lita, their precious daughter, from marrying Jim, her would-be killer. But they wondered how he did it. He was 1,000 miles away in Palm Beach, Florida. Valencia, Lita's sister, learned from her mother of Lita's death. Valencia said, "I knew instantly Jim had done it. The second I heard that she's been shot, I knew he had done it. Who else would want to kill her?"
Oh, yeah. I mean, Jim would be the top suspect here, especially with all the money stuff. Like, it has to be him.
Yeah. Now, after the shooting, Poppy called Richard Schiffman, who is Lita's attorney. And he recalled that Poppy was hysterical as she let him know that Lita had been shot. Then shortly after Poppy's call, Joanne called him and told him that Lita was murdered. This was the first time Schiffman had been in a situation where his client was murdered. Schiffman later said, "I called Jack Turner and Wilbur Warner, who are Sullivan's divorce attorneys, to let them know what had happened and then notified the court. I wasn't going to tell the judge until we got down there that afternoon, but I warned people from the security standpoint to keep their eyes open a little more than normal because we had no idea what the story was."
Now, the final hearing for the divorce was also that day, too. So I guess now it's canceled and Jim doesn't have to worry about losing any of his money because Lita's dead.
Yeah, exactly. Lita is dead. Jim said the first time he heard that his wife died was when the attorney called him at about 9:30 in the morning.
Which I guess was his confirmation that the plan went accordingly.
Yeah, everything was panning out the way that Jim intended. And actually, he was seeing someone else while he was still married to Lita.
Not surprising.
Her name is Suki, who would soon to be his replacement wife. And literally, a half hour after getting this confirmation that Lita was murdered, he calls her up to tell her the news. But here's the thing, Jim didn't sound upset at all. If anything, he sounded excited. He said, hey, guess what? She got killed.
Yeah, so my wife's dead now, so we could probably, yeah.
And Suki didn't know what her boyfriend was even talking about at the time. And he continued to explain, Lita got killed. After all, it's better for us.
Talk about a red flag. Golly.
And later that day, he went out and played tennis, like in the afternoon. And he had no comment for the reporter who was asking him about his wife's death.
So to me, it seems like he thought he was scot-free. Completely under the radar.
Yeah, he's like, I mean, I'm in Florida. I'm not in Georgia where it happened. Like, how could it be me? Look at me. I'm playing tennis, you know.
This is the best alibi.
Yeah. He also didn't give any comment to Joanne or Emery, Lita's parents, who were completely devastated. They never received a phone call from him. He never sent them a card or even flowers or anything. Instead, his first wife, Catherine, and his children from his first marriage, if you remember them, they called the parents and showed their sympathy. The children adored Lita, and they were upset with her death. But with Jim, it was like nothing. And Jim even worsened the wound. The afternoon of Lita's death, Sullivan's attorneys called Richard Schiffman, who's Lita's attorney, and he described the phone call he received. Schiffman said, Jack Taylor, who's one of Jim's attorneys, he called and said that he wanted me to call the McClintons to tell them not to steal anything from the house. And he remembered telling them to go to hell. He told them if he thought I was going to call the parents that day that their daughter was murdered and say, don't steal, they were crazy. I wouldn't do it.
Why would he even say something like that? They just lost their daughter. They're not going to be stealing things. It kind of just shows you like where his mind is.
Yeah, like material things.
Right. He doesn't care about anything else.
I'm sure stealing was the last thing on their mind. Because as long as he bought something, it was his. He owned it. Therefore, he considered himself the owner of all of Lita's possessions, including her clothing and her jewelry. And matter of fact, the jewelry that he bought for her, he kept the jewelry in the safe. Therefore, if she wanted to wear it, she would have to ask him for permission.
Oh my gosh.
After receiving the news from the doctor, the McClintons drove back to Lita's house, each in their separate cars. Their hearts were in pain, about to explode from anger and sadness. They arrived at the house where the officers had converged upon Lita's house like ants. Valencia, Lita's sister, was already at the home. Joanne and Emery Sr. walked through the front doorway. They see Valencia's husband using a tissue to pick something from the foyer floor. It takes a minute to process, but then he realizes he's picking up some of Lita's brain tissue.
Oh, that's awful.
Yeah. Joanne said it was difficult. She told someone afterwards, I don't know who I asked for a cigarette, but I started smoking after that. Lita's family arranged to have the funeral for the following day, on Martin Luther King Jr. Day, a federal holiday. And it makes sense that Jim, he takes no part in the arrangements and he doesn't show up for the funeral. The only time they heard from him is when the funeral director told Joanne and Emery that since Lita was still technically married to Jim, they needed Jim's permission to cremate the body.
Ugh, I feel like they definitely need to look closer into the cause of death before giving Jim any type of permission.
I know. Valencia, she remembers that her husband, Jeff, had to make the call to Jim to get permission. Since Jim was still legally her next of kin, her family couldn't have her cremated without his approval, she explained. And she said her husband called down to Palm Beach to speak with Jim. And she'll never forget the look on Jeff's face when he came back into the room. He was in shock. He said, I can't believe that man. It was like he didn't even care. He basically said, why are you bothering me? Do whatever you want with her. Then Jim, he sends Lita's family a response through a telegram that reads, my permission given to cremate Lita Sullivan, James Sullivan. And so while everyone is in Atlanta, all of Lita's friends and all of her family, they attended her funeral and mourned for her. Jim, he was busy with something much more important, making arrangements for a party that he was throwing the following Sunday.
A party? Like, my wife is dead, I'm officially divorced type party?
That may have been the real reason, partially. But apparently he was having a party to help fundraise money for Mayor Evelyn Dede Merrick's re-election. And, you know, this was something that could have easily have been canceled or rescheduled, being the circumstances. Mayor Merrick's would have understood. However, the thought never crossed Jim's mind.
The show must go on, Ashley.
He did make one important phone call. When Catherine, his first wife, found out that Lita had died, she had called him to make sure of the news. Her phone call reminded him that he needed to call his parents before someone else called them. And he makes the call short to his parents. He tells them that his new wife was murdered. But they actually didn't even know that he was married to Lita in the first place.
Oh, so he wasn't very close to his parents, I'd assume.
Right. And Jim and Lita, they were married for a while, more than a decade.
Dang.
And if you think all of Jim's actions were insensitive and inconsiderate during this time, he added in some sprinkles to his concoction, too. So during the week following Lita's death, Jim releases a statement. In this statement, he writes in a not-so-subtle way that Lita struggled with a cocaine addiction. He said her cocaine addiction may have been a motive in her murder. Apparently, Lita had dabbled in cocaine, but she didn't have an addiction. However, Jim took advantage of this fact, and when the autopsy report showed Lita had traces of cocaine in her system, Jim said the report added more support to his theory. He basically said Lita was involved in a drug deal that went wrong. And he also accused Lita of stealing diamonds from the safe. He knew that in her affidavit, which was taken before the final divorce hearing, that she acknowledged she had taken the diamonds from one of her necklaces, because she knew that she was going to need the money for her attorney's fees. But Jim failed to mention that part of the story. Instead, he said Lita wanted the diamonds for money to feed her cocaine addiction.
So not only now is his wife dead, but he's reaching for all of these excuses, tainting her name, and I don't know, he just didn't need to do all that.
And for all we know, I mean, he could have easily given her cocaine somehow just so that it is in her body.
Right.
But he acted so innocent when he told the police about the diamonds. He said, if that isn't the definition of someone in need of money for a bad habit, then I'd like to know one. Understand, I'm a simple layman who has done nothing but work hard for my money, one nickel and dime at a time.
Wow. So he claims he earned his money based off of hard work.
Mm-hmm.
More like he piggybacked his success and possibly even killed for it.
Yeah, I mean, maybe he's talking about the hard work he had to do to off someone for an inheritance.
Maybe.
He also had some more to say about Lita. He said that Lita was having multiple extramarital affairs when she had gone on several dates with two men. She was never in an exclusive relationship, and when she started dating, the two of them were in the middle of a divorce.
And if you remember, he had been cheating on Lita since the first year that they were married.
Yeah.
This was nothing new.
I'm sure he didn't mention that at all. But he just didn't have to drag her name through the mud. But there might have been a reason that he did this. When the police heard of all this information, they seemed to believe what he was saying. And they didn't know Jim yet. They began to think that Lita was manipulative, an adulteress, and a drug user. Jim was controlling a narrative before they even had the chance to even look into him.
Well, at this point, it seems like he's a master manipulator. I mean, this type of behavior is well practiced. Like, this is right up his alley.
Yeah, and Lita, she was nothing like how he described her to police. And he didn't just blame Lita, who is the victim. He also blamed Lita's parents. He said the McClintons could have had their daughter killed because they wanted to collect on her life insurance policy. While it is true that they were beneficiaries, it was only because Lita had been traveling alone in Asia. She wanted to have insurance in Asia while she was traveling because she was traveling alone. Jim wasn't going with her. He was divorcing her. Conveniently, he left everything that betrayed him in a negative way out of the narrative.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's pretty clear. All he's doing is pointing fingers at this point.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. He's talking about how bad Lita is. He doesn't mention anything about how their marriage was or anything that he did in the relationship. 9 days after Lita McClinton's murder, Detective Marshall Harris, a respected investigator known for his work on the Atlanta missing and murdered children case, traveled to Palm Beach to question Jim Sullivan at his attorney's office. And during the meeting, Warren Holmes, who's a well-known Miami polygraph expert, administered a lie detector test to Jim, and he passed, suggesting that he had no involvement in Lita's murder. Detective Harris found Jim to be friendly, and soon after seeing the results, Jim made sure the media widely reported that he had been cleared. However, years later, investigators gathered enough evidence to prove that Jim had orchestrated a murder-for-hire plot.
And I think this is a really good example of why polygraphs aren't always reliable. They don't actually detect lies. They just measure things like heart rate, blood pressure, sweating. And the thing is, a lot of people can control these things.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
I don't know. I was reading something recently that said, like, certain people who are either trained or even like psychopaths can actually control these emotions and kind of manipulate the results of these types of testing.
Isn't that just crazy?
Yeah.
That's actually wild. Yeah. Psychopaths, for example, they don't react to stress the same way most people do. So their lies might not even register. And trained people, they can use little tricks like controlling their breathing or tensing their muscles in their feet to throw the test off.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, all in all, I think these tests are only like 80 or 90% accurate. So it's really hard to go off of one of those and come to any type of conclusion, really. I think that's why most courts don't even allow using them as evidence. I mean, imagine a whole jury going off of a test like this is just black and white. Like, well, he failed the polygraph test, so he's obviously lying, or he passed, whatever.
Yeah, and just like you said, polygraphs also pick up on sweating. They measure something called electrodermal activity, EDA, or galvanic skin response, GSR, which basically tracks how well your skin conducts electricity. Since sweat makes your skin more conductive, the polygraph can detect even tiny amounts of it, sometimes way before you even realize you're sweating.
Which is interesting because I always thought like a polygraph test really only measured like brain waves or something. Like if you worried about something, it would show a spike.
Me too. Yeah.
But wow, there's some science involved.
Yeah. So like when people get nervous or they get stressed, like when they're lying, their sweat glands kick in, especially on their palms or their fingertips. And the polygraph can record that along with things like heart rate, blood pressure, and breathing to look for signs of deception. But just like you said, Ricky, some people can actually control their stress responses or use little tricks to throw the test off, which is why polygraphs aren't always reliable.
Which makes you think maybe Jim was a psychopath. And he was able to kind of manipulate this type of thing.
True. It's possible. He constantly lied to Lita. He constantly lied to his friends and family. He had some experiences with lying over the years.
Yeah, for sure.
So Jim, who is full of surprises, he comes up with another stunt.
Stuntman Sullivan, the real evil Knievel.
A month after Lita's murder on Valentine's Day, Jim still didn't trust that the McClintons wouldn't take anything from Lita's home on Slayton Drive. So he had his attorneys depose Emery Sr. and Joanne at their office. While Lita's parents were reassuring Jim's attorneys that they hadn't taken anything, Jim took advantage of the moment. He arranged for a moving truck and movers to clear out all of Lita's belongings. By the time the McClintons got back to the house, after a call from a concerned neighbor, the house was completely empty. It's not like they had any plans to steal anything in the first place. But at the same time, these were grieving parents. Things like Lita's photos, her clothes, her personal keepsakes, things that they only had left of Lita, they were gone. Joanne remembered how she tried to retrieve something important from Lita's house, something relating to her taxes. But by then, it was too late. She and Emery had told the police multiple times about it, but in the end, Jim was the one given permission to clear out the house, and that's exactly what he did while they were talking with Jim's attorneys. By that point, though, Joanne was completely numb. The worst thing in the world had already happened to her. She lost her daughter, and anything that Jim said he was going to do, it's like she was just completely numb to it, and she just expected it at this point. And then he took another advantage of her death.
Not surprising.
Lita died in January, right? Well, 2 months later, in March, Jim returned to Barrett Bank to apply for another loan. I know there's a lot to unload with this story, so you might not remember, but when Lita was alive, Jim had tried to get an earlier loan, but bank officials had denied the request because Jim couldn't provide them with a signature from his wife. Now that Lita's deceased,
he doesn't need her signature.
Yeah. They didn't need a signature. They just needed a copy of Lita's death certificate confirming that she was deceased.
That sly dog.
Mm-hmm. This time around, there was no hassle to get a loan. The bank approved a $950,000 loan to pay off two mortgages on his Palm Beach mansion. Shortly afterward, he put Lita's townhouse on the market. He sold it for $575,000 and made a profit of $135,000. Now his mansion was secure, he made some money from the sale of Lita's home, and he was set to start another new life with a new woman.
Wow, clean slate, easy peasy. So the new woman, this is Suki, right?
Yeah, Suki, who we previously mentioned, and they began dating and sleeping together while Jim was still married to Lita. She was the new replacement, basically. Members of the Palm Beach could tell that there was something off about Jim. One resident, Jonathan Commander, said, "I never heard anything nice about the guy. He stalked the women over there. He had a particular taste for Eurasian women, and if there was anyone of that description around, he'd be hovering over her. He was not very socially acceptable, and although you are surprised when anyone kills somebody, I think anyone that knew him, the first thought they had was, he did it." So at some point, the police, they started realizing that maybe they have been looking in the wrong place. They were coming to their senses, too. They realized that Lita's death seemed to be a little too convenient for Jim.
Well, he almost got away with it. But stuntman Sullivan's not too sly.
Yeah, I mean, it's about time. After 4 months after Lita's murder, the Atlanta police got a big break. They were able to subpoena Jim's phone records from the previous year. So while they're going through the records, they made a startling but exciting discovery. On the day Lita was murdered, January 16th, Jim had received a collect call from a Georgia number at 9 o'clock in the morning. This would have been immediately after Lita's murder. So why would Jim receive a phone call from someone in Georgia at this time? He had told Atlanta police that he learned of his wife's death later in the day, not less than an hour after the shooting occurred.
Well, I mean, that's a break in the case.
Yeah, you would think. And they tried to figure out who made this phone call. Detective Harris, he tried calling the number, but the number just rang and rang. And there was no one answering the phone. There was no answering machine or what we would know today as a voicemail. But that didn't stop Detective Harris. He tries again and again. Then finally, someone picks up. The voice on the other end said, "Hello?" Detective Harris replied, "Good morning. I'm wondering if you could tell me whose number this belongs to." The voice at the other end laughed. "I have no idea. I just picked it up. This is a payphone." If he couldn't find out who had the number, he could at least get the location. He found out from the person who answered the payphone that the phone was located right off the highway near Sewanee, Georgia. This location was about 40 minutes away from Lita's townhouse, which was the same time it would have taken for the killer to reach the payphone after the shooting. It made sense that someone had called Jim to let him know that Lita was dead.
Sounds like a pretty good clue to me. But I can't help but to think, wouldn't it have been funny if he was caught because it was like a collect call? Like, remember there was an old commercial that they had a baby and they were like cheap. So he made a collect call from "Add a baby, it's a boy." "Add a baby is a boy." And the mom or the grandma was like, the wife, whatever, was like, "Who was it?" And he's like, "Oh, it was Jeff. They had a baby and it's a boy." Do you remember that commercial?
Mm-hmm. I forgot about that. Good memory. Your nighttime bedroom temperature has a huge impact on your sleep quality. If you wake up too hot or too cold, I highly recommend you check out Miracle Made's bed sheets. Miracle Made sheets are inspired by NASA and use silver-infused fabrics that are temperature regulated so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. And did you know that traditional bed sheets, they can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat?
Ew, but no.
Yeah, and it can lead to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses, and it's just gross. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. So basically, these sheets are self-cleaning. And what I also love about them is they're luxuriously comfortable without that high price tag of other luxury brands. Upgrade your sleep this year. Go to trymiracle.com/crimesalad to try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use our promo code CRIMESALAD at checkout, you'll get a free 3-piece towel set and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiracle.com/crimesalad and use the code CRIMESALAD to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/crimesalad to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Anyways, Detective Harris, he thought this was a great clue too, a great lead. So he and Lieutenant Walker, they had to fly down to Palm Beach again to ask Jim some more questions. Lieutenant Walker was the head of Atlanta's homicide task force. Jim was of no help, of course. He said that he had no memory of this phone call at all. Jim had a theory about the mysterious phone call. He said it must have been a wrong number. He also gave another theory. Maybe it was one of the housekeepers who had answered the call. There were so many phones and so many rooms, it wasn't out of the question that a housekeeper just answered the phone. This time, Detective Harris didn't come out of the interrogation room saying that Jim was such a friendly man. He said Jim was cooperative, but he and Lieutenant Walker still had so many leads to follow. He told reporters he's not ruling out anything and no one. The only person I know for sure didn't kill her is me. Then September rolls around. The reward money for any information on Lita's murder rose to $20,000. An anonymous donor donated $15,000 to the prize. $2,000 came from Governor Frank Harris, the McClintons' family friend, and the other $3,000 came from private citizens. After the prize money increased, Detective Harris gave the media another quote. He said, "I'm sure that whoever hit Lita, if it was a contract hit, killed her for a lot less than $20,000. We know only one person did the shooting, but we've got 3 actors. There are 2 other people involved who did not pull the trigger, but they can be prosecuted for murder." Detective Harris wanted to instill fear in those who were involved in the killing.
I've always wondered if those types of rewards actually work. Did it work in this case?
Yeah, I know. I wonder that too. But no, unfortunately, it didn't. While the Atlanta police are investigating the case, Jim and Suki, they get married on September 15th, 1987, 8 months after Lita's murder. It's Jim's 3rd marriage, and it's Suki's 4th wedding.
Wow. Soulmates. Made for each other.
They had the wedding at the Royal Poinciana Chapel. It was a small ceremony with a few friends. And this marriage was different than his other two. So before Suki got married to Jim, she had a catch. She told him she was not going to be his 3rd wife if none of their Palm Beach mansion belonged to her. She added that when her ex-husband had refused to add her name on the deed to their home, she had started an affair with Jim. So later that day, on the day of their marriage, both Jim and Suki went to the municipal building where Suki watched her new husband sign papers, making her a co-owner of their home. Jim fought long and hard to avoid giving Lita any money or having any of her own possessions. Everything was his. And he reminded her of that all the time. But on this first day of his marriage to Suki, Jim makes her a co-owner of the house.
It makes you wonder what's different with Suki compared to Lita and Catherine. Because it's almost like she had a spell over him. Like maybe she's as cold-hearted as he is.
Possibly. Other people, they were wondering the same thing. Some thought the answer was that she looked like a goddess. Men could not look away from her beauty. Jim and many others viewed Suki as a trophy. The couple become fixtures around the town. They attend parties and galas of important people. They become world travelers, and they spend a lot of money. Suki has multiple closets throughout the mansion, which are filled with extravagant gowns and very expensive jewelry. And Jim, he doesn't work. Instead, he lounges in the spa, or you could spot him playing tennis, or he drives around in Lita's old Mercedes. In the evenings, they socialize with Palm Beach's elite, the wealthy, powerful, and well-known.
Yeah, it almost seems like a power couple. Because with Lita, he kind of hid her, like didn't really want to admit that he's even with her. But with Suki, she's front and center.
Yeah.
Like you said, though, this could be a trophy wife, almost a possession of his.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. Because with Lita, it was kind of strange. It was almost as if Lita's race had something to do with their relationship, because African-Americans weren't as accepted in Mason, Georgia, or in Palm Beach, Florida. But even if race was a factor, you would have thought Jim would have shown more support to Lita. But he didn't offer any to his wife. And although Jim and Suki, they're living it up, they're having a lot of fun, the Atlanta police have not forgotten about Jim. They still want to solve Lita's murder. They began looking into that $1 million loan application Jim puts in for his house a few weeks before Lita's death. And it is suspicious because during the time when Lita was still alive, the bank wouldn't give him that loan without his wife's signature. And if you remember, Lita was refusing to sign anything for Jim unless he provided her with the items she wanted in the divorce, like the Atlanta house and the alimony. And Jim, he was never going to give up any items to Lita, even though those items were rightfully hers. So it is suspicious when he turns around after Lita is murdered 2 months after, and he gets this $1 million loan with her death certificate. And as we mentioned, he did this to pay off and refinance the loans for the mortgage on his house, which is the expensive mansion that he shares with Suki. And when the Atlanta police found out about this loan, officers asked the Florida State Attorney's Office to investigate the loan more, and they discovered that when Lita refused to sign the papers, Jim had listed himself as single on the loan application.
Oh, that's suspicious. Single and ready to mingle.
Yeah, while he was still married to Lita.
It's kind of like foreshadowing.
Mm-hmm. And there was more to this. So investigators found out that Jim had listed himself as married on his 1985 tax return and also having four dependents, even though Lita had filed for divorce by that time. And it had been years since his biological children have lived with him or even, you know, seen him.
Well, he needs those tax breaks.
Yeah, because if you remember, his first wife, Catherine, she took the children and left before Jim had met Lita. When the bank discovered this lie, bank officials denied the loan. Hence, Jim had a big reason for wanting to kill Lita, that he didn't want to give up any of his money or belongings to his wife. While they had a motive, the Atlanta police needed proof to show that Jim was the mastermind.
And this is cool because this gives another possible motive. So not only did he not want to give alimony or whatever to his wife, he also was going to financially gain from this also. Crazy.
It is. So although the police were onto something, it seemed like there was a pretty clear motive. A year had passed and the police didn't seem to be any closer to proving anything. Joanne told the media, "This tragedy has left an open wound that will be with us for the rest of our lives. The apprehension of the person responsible is a daily concern." Now, when you put that into perspective, a daily concern, this has gone on for, what, a year now? Waking up every morning, not knowing if the person who took your daughter's life will ever be held accountable. That kind of pain doesn't fade. It lingers. It just eats away at you. And you want answers. You just want something, anything to finally break the case. And then finally, a new clue emerges. A year after the murder, the Fulton County District Attorney's Office, they get a letter from a man named Johnny Austin Turner. Now, Fulton County covers Atlanta, so this is big. Turner isn't just some random guy. He is a police informant and a convicted forger sitting in a Georgia prison. And what he has to say, it changes everything.
So I'm not sure we can trust a convicted felon, but What did he say?
So Turner's letter had interesting details. He writes about how he met with an old pal at an Atlanta bar when he was out on parole in April of 1987. This pal's name was Thomas Bryce Henley. Henley, who was with a black man, was carrying a wad of cash and doing some bragging, the kind of bragging that you shouldn't be bragging about. He talked about doing a hit on a black woman who lived in Buckhead a few months beforehand.
Okay, this sounds familiar.
Yeah, so the Atlanta police, they believed the only Buckhead woman it could be was Lita. Immediately, Detective Harris, Detective Jackson, Atlanta police, and Special Agent Robert Ingram, who were with the Georgia Bureau of Investigation, rushed to ask Turner some questions. When the detectives arrived, Turner told them that Henley looked like the sketch they had of the driver, the same person who had purchased the pink roses. Now, at first, Turner didn't know who the black man was. Then the detectives showed him a photo lineup of six black men. Turner looked at each of the six photographs very carefully. Then he pointed to picture number five as the black man he saw in the bar with Henley. That picture was of Marvin Marble, Poppy's ex-husband.
What? Poppy's ex-husband might have been involved?
According to Turner.
God, his own kid was in the house.
Yeah. So the Atlanta police, they weren't very sure what the evidence showed. Maybe now they had the identities of every man involved in the killing, but they needed to investigate further because it's common for inmates to rat on each other, hoping that in exchange, they will receive a free pass out of prison or a lesser sentence. It doesn't help that Marvin, who was once questioned, denied everything. And when the detectives investigate further, they find nothing connecting Marvin to Henley, except for Turner's story. And to see if maybe there was something missing from Turner's story, Robert Ingram, a Georgia Bureau of Investigation special agent, he asked for Turner to take a polygraph test. Turner's responses show that he was lying repeatedly. When the officer sees this, they throw Turner's story to the side.
Oh man, what a waste of time. Seems so close. Now, was this just to throw them off?
It could have been, but like I mentioned, a lot of inmates try to do this to try to, you know, get a lesser sentence somehow, or because they're done, you know, like there's no other chance for them to get parole or to get, you know, a lesser sentence. So this might be like their last chance.
Okay.
So people, they may have been suspicious of Jim, you know, like neighbors, friends of Lita's, her family, but it didn't stop him from moving up in the ranks. And the Palm Beach Town Council unanimously voted to appoint Jim to a second 3-year term with the Landmarks Preservation Commission. And they made him chair of the commission. This meant that any Palm Beach residents who wanted to renovate their house or property had to go through Jim. And as you know, Jim loved to have power.
Well, he definitely liked power, but I feel like that also was his downfall. Power made him delusional.
Yeah, and the power actually got to his head. We'll explain this even more. So 18 months after Lita's death, July of 1988, Jim, he starts to run low on cash. Suki, she's spending a lot of the money, and she's comfortable having this lavish lifestyle. And so he gets another idea.
Don't tell me it's another hit for money.
Well, this time his stunt involves his very own daughter. His oldest child, who's now 22 years old, Deirdre. He gets in contact with her, which was probably a little surprising. She's now 22 years old, and he wanted nothing to do with her growing up. So Jim wants his daughter to sign away her claim to a trust fund. There's a problem. Deirdre never even knew that she had a trust fund in the amount of $15,000.
Could you imagine what that conversation would be like? Hey, you have a trust fund that's worth $15,000. Can you sign it back to me?
You know what Benjamin Franklin said, right?
Nope.
A penny saved is a penny earned. So I guess Jim, he was a strong believer in Franklin's quote. Seriously, though, Deirdre thought her father's ask was very odd. She also wanted to find out more about this trust fund. So she hired a lawyer, and the lawyer finds out that Jim had started a trust fund for each of his four children in 1980, and the funds were started by the mortgage payments he collected on the Mason house. But now he wanted the money. But Lita was supposed to be the trustee of the fund. And Deirdre is supposed to have the money in the trust fund when she turns 21. Well, now she's 22.
Yeah, I mean, that's her money.
Deirdre's attorney gives the court an explanation of what happened. He says, in the light of the lack of contact between the Sullivan family and James Sullivan, Catherine, Jim's first wife, and Deirdre were, at best, shocked, and at worst, suspicious about the letter and legal papers they had received from Mr. Sullivan. And the courts listened. Aside from Lita's murder, where Jim is the number one suspect, Jim has been in and out of court for multiple reasons, from trying to steal Deirdre's trust fund money, to suing contractors, to fighting unpaid parking tickets, and he's late with his taxes. The courts are tired of this guy. In April of 1989, more than 2 years after Lita's murder, Jim appears in traffic court for the 18th time. In 6 years, Jim had 11 speeding tickets and 7 other traffic violations. The judge was exhausted, and so he suspends Jim's driver's license for 5 years. This is just one example of how Jim let the power get to his head.
Yeah, I mean, I like that example. Screw this guy. He needs consequences. He feels like he's completely above the law and everyone.
Yeah, exactly. But even though the judge suspended Jim's license for 5 years, Jim ignores the suspension. He just continues to drive around town. No big deal. As for his children's trust funds, it wasn't the first time that Jim had stolen from his children's money. When he was married to Lita, he had covered their vacation expenses with his children's trust fund money. Back in Atlanta, the police, they needed extra help. So in the spring of 1988, they brought in FBI Special Agent John Kingston. At this time, Kingston was already working on another murder-for-hire case, making him a valuable resource. He was also familiar with the federal law that passed a few years earlier, which made it a crime to use interstate communications or travel to plan or carry out a contract killing. This law would be crucial in Lita's case.
Just so I understand, this is if someone communicates with someone across state lines, that would automatically make this a federal case then, right?
Exactly. So this is awesome. I mean, an FBI agent is now going to look into this case. This is huge.
Mm-hmm.
This is big. So when the Atlanta police discovered that phone call made from a Georgia payphone to Jim's Palm Beach mansion in Florida, they believed the crime became a federal crime. Therefore, it made sense to seek assistance from the FBI.
The big boys.
So to start helping, Special Agent Kingston and John Coffey flew down to meet Jim in April of 1988. And when they got there, Jim told them the same story he had told the Atlanta police. Lita was having multiple affairs and had a large cocaine addiction. Jim specifically said the cocaine addiction was what tore their relationship apart. What bothers me the most with all of this going on is he's still trying to tarnish Lita's reputation. After she's been murdered, it's just totally unfair.
Yeah, I agree.
And Jim continued with the story. He said, Lita was killed with a 9mm. The Atlanta police tell me that's the preferred weapon of drug dealers.
Of course, he's just running with this.
Yeah. The FBI spoke with Jim for about 45 minutes. As they asked more and more questions, Jim became evasive in his answers. Then they asked him about the collect phone call that was made from the payphone. Jim continued to be evasive. He said, I don't have the faintest idea what you're talking about. I received no such call. Then he stood up, indicating to the two FBI men that he was no longer answering any of their questions.
Well, he knew they were onto him at this point.
Oh, yeah. And the FBI special agent, John Kingston, he vividly recalled his interview with Jim Sullivan. He noticed that the more Sullivan lied, the more his behavior changed. He became evasive, avoided eye contact. He looked down, making his deception obvious. Kingston later shared these observations with author Deb Miller Landau, who was researching the case for her book, A Devil Went Down to Georgia, Race, Power, Privilege, and the Murder of Lita McClinton. Kingston said that when he first arrived in Palm Beach, he didn't have an opinion about whether or not Jim was guilty. He was there to form an opinion. Then after talking to him, Kingston said, I knew when I left that interview, I was 100% sure he was guilty. Now we just need to prove it. And when Kingston came on the case, he wanted to do a more in-depth research on the case, looking closer at Jim's phone records from before and after the murder. When Kingston was looking through the phone records, He found something. He remembered from reading the case notes that Lita's neighbor, Bob Christensen, had told Atlanta police that 3 days before the murder, on January 13th, Jim had called him asking if he had seen anything strange happening in the area. That was also the same day that there had been a knock on Lita's door in the early hours of the day. But it was too early. Lita didn't get out of bed. The subpoenaed phone records showed that before Jim had called Bob, he had called a number at a Howard Johnson motel, which was about 5.5 miles north of Lita's townhouse. Kingston wondered who he was calling. And you have to remember, he was in Florida during this time.
Yeah, I mean, why would he be calling someone at a motel near Lita?
And Kingston had the same thought. So he drives to the Howard Johnson motel and he asks the staff for past records. They hand him a box labeled 1987. And inside, he finds a paper registration card and a folder for room 518. The records show that someone using the name Johnny Furr checked into the room at 7:24 a.m. on January 13th. That same morning, someone had knocked on Lita's door, and it was also the day that Jim called Lita's neighbor, Bob. 3 days after this person booked a room, Lita was murdered. So this new find was too suspicious to ignore.
Yeah, especially the name Johnny Furr.
Yeah, Johnny Furr had checked into the room with two other individuals whose names weren't on the list, and they recorded their car as a 1985 Toy, short for Toyota, and the individual had given his address as Raleigh, North Carolina.
Oh, North Carolina. Well, that's familiar. The flower shop guy, he said he saw a license plate for North Carolina.
Yeah.
Whew, small world.
And it also was a Toyota. The dots are starting to connect.
The wheels are turning.
And on top of this, the police had a working theory that three men were involved in the murder: the man who purchased the flowers, the driver, and the shooter. The record for the motel room supported that theory. The motel's phone records also provided more evidence. Someone in room 518 had made a phone call to Jim's house at 7:44 in the morning. And Jim's phone records showed that he, or someone in the house, had called the motel back at 10:33 a.m., right before Jim made that phone call to Bob to see if there's anything suspicious going on.
Okay, so the puzzle pieces are coming together.
Kingston does some more digging, and he finds out that the address on the registration card is fake. The street address of Rural Road number 40, zip code of 28112. And he runs the driver's license for names of Johnny, John, and Jonathan Furr. And more than 150 results come up for a very small area near the North Carolina town of Mooresville, whose zip code is similar. Kingston takes out a map, draws a circle around that area, which includes parts of Albemarle, Concord, and Kannapolis. He knows that most lies always have some part of the truth, and he felt confident that the people involved came from within this circle.
This guy was really good. I mean, he's been on the case for a short time, and he's already light years ahead of what the local police was able to do in a much longer period of time.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible that the local police department were handling multiple cases at once, making it difficult to keep up with the demands of each investigation. But yeah, I agree. It's amazing that he was able to be brought onto this case. Kingston's next plan is to drive to North Carolina with another FBI agent, Todd Letcher. And they want to talk to people. They want to show them sketches to see if anyone recognizes any of the sketches that they have. Kingston also said, "I also planned on knocking on the door of every single Johnny Furr and showing them the artist sketches."
That's a lot of Johnny Furrs. 150? He's going to knock on all their doors. This dude is determined.
Determined for sure. But Kingston never gets the chance to go to North Carolina because FBI rules require agents to get approval from the special agent in charge, which is the SAC, of the local field office. And in this case, it's Charlotte, North Carolina. So before conducting an investigation in another state, you would need an approval. And this approval usually comes through in less than 8 hours. But after waiting a full week with no response, Kingston and Letcher start losing patience. Determined to move forward with this case, they decided to go to North Carolina anyway. But just as they were on their way, their boss calls with bad news. Their request has been denied.
Why would they be denied? They're making so much progress and they're potentially going to find a murderer. Actually, three people.
And Kingston agreed. It was the strangest thing, he said. Nobody ever said no. Of the 56 field offices in the entire bureau, we get the only one who won't let us come into their division. So what they do instead is they meet FBI agents from North Carolina at a Cracker Barrel near the state border, and the agents tell Kingston and Letcher that they will take over investigating the North Carolina part of this case. And Kingston knew the North Carolina agents were not going to put in as much work as he and Letcher had planned to do, because they were just not as invested in the case. I mean, the two of them had planned to spend a week in North Carolina.
So really, this isn't about, you know, finding justice for Lita's family or getting Jim behind bars. This is literally a pissing match.
Yeah, it seemed like there was a lot of like ego involved. Like, this is our area, you know, seemed like it anyway.
Good job, but we'll take over from here.
Yeah. And Lita's poor family, while all this is happening, they're suffering because they just want justice. And the murderers who are behind Lita's death are free. And Jim may have been free, but he also had a talent for finding trouble. In March of 1990, more than 3 years after Lita's murder, Jim gets into a three-car accident a few miles from his house. Now, Jim is not at fault, but when the police officers look at Jim's driving record, he notices something. Jim's driver's license is suspended. He shouldn't be driving for 5 years. And yet here he is behind the steering wheel. And Jim also had an expired registration and expired Georgia tags when he's living in Florida. So the police officer had to write him up a ticket. And Jim could have just paid the fine and the whole ordeal would have been over. But Jim had to make it a bigger deal than what it was.
Well, of course he did. It's in his nature.
So when Jim shows up to traffic court with Suki, he tells the judge that she was actually the one driving the car. So when the court officer swears Suki in, she also testifies under oath that she was the driver. With the confusion over the case, the prosecutor decided to drop the charge, and the judge dismissed it. But here's the twist. Before court, Jim had convinced Suki to take the blame for the ticket. What he didn't expect was that Frank Cerubino, a determined reporter, was in the courtroom that day, and he was there to ask Jim questions about Lita's murder case. But something about what he saw in the court didn't sit right with him. As he thought it over, it became more clear. Who was driving shouldn't have mattered in the first place. The ticket wasn't for a moving violation. It was for an expired registration and tag. So why go through all the trouble of switching up the story? Something wasn't adding up. So when Cerubino realizes that it really shouldn't matter who was behind the wheel, he becomes interested in finding out more about the citation. He finds the officer who ticketed Jim and asks him who was driving when he handed out the ticket. Let's just say the officer was a little annoyed with this question. He said, "Do you think I can't tell the difference between Suki and Jim Sullivan?" And it gets even better. The officer tells Cerubino that Jim was the only person driving that day. And he remembers the event very well because Jim was driving a Rolls Royce. And it's not every day that he tickets a driver of a Rolls Royce. As he looked into the situation more, he finds out that Suki doesn't even have a Florida driver's license. Now, just because the law hasn't caught up with Jim doesn't mean that they weren't investigating. In April of 1990, a federal grand jury convenes. Court officials want to see if they can get a grand jury indictment against Jim. The jury starts to hear witness testimonies to see if the prosecution has enough evidence to bring charges against Jim. The grand jury doesn't decide if Jim is innocent or guilty. The grand jury decides if there's enough evidence to bring a case against Jim. So the jurors, who represent a cross-section of the population in the area, listen to the evidence. They hear about the roses, where they were purchased. They learned about the phone records. They learned of the eyewitness accounts of the shooting and the Howard Johnson evidence. While it seems like there is overwhelming evidence, the jurors decide that all of this evidence is circumstantial. There is no physical evidence, like having a gun or solid evidence of a hitman or even hitmen. And police still aren't sure how many people are involved.
And how disappointing for the McLennans, because they know that Jim is guilty.
Yeah, this would be extremely exhausting because it seems like the police are so close. Like, they have circumstantial evidence. Everything, you know, looks to be like Jim is definitely guilty, but they just need to find that solid evidence somehow. According to an article from NPR that was written April 30th, 2023, the rate at which murders are solved has been decreasing for decades. But in 2020, the clearance rate of murder cases hit a new low at slightly below 50%, which is interesting. So a clearance rate refers to how often a case is considered solved, usually by making an arrest or identifying a suspect. Since the rate is declining, it means more murder cases are being left unsolved, which makes it harder for victims' families to get justice. Which cases could be very well similar to Lita's case. You know, it's like they know who it is, they just need to get that evidence. Yet the Atlanta police are still working on Lita's case.
Well, at least they aren't letting it go cold.
So in Florida, Jim, he's facing financial hardships. When he moves to Palm Beach, he became pretty good friends with a man by the name of George Bissell. George was at Jim and Suki's wedding. So when George had asked Jim to invest in his business, Jim didn't hesitate. He invested $1.5 million in Bissell's company.
Dang, that's a lot of money. Was this the Bissell vacuum? Sucked up all Jim's money.
Well, that's a good guess. But no, Bissell was actually in the orchard and agricultural business in Apopka, Florida. George told Jim that if he puts money down now, he would get more than what he paid for when the expensive palms and orchids he purchased matured. Jim didn't know that this investment was actually an elaborate Ponzi scheme where early investors are paid when new people invest. Jim even became a spokesman for the company. Just as the feds had been investigating Jim, they had also been investigating George. And in 1990, the feds came after George and his partner with charges in federal court. Afterward, Jim was never able to recover the $1.5 million investment.
Ooh, let's just chalk that one up to karma.
But he wouldn't give anything to his family, or Lita, or Catherine, even.
Well, I mean, that's the greed. He just wanted to spend money to make money.
So when Jim lost his money, he could see the fortune he had in his bank account dwindling. This is when he tried to keep Suki from spending so much money. Unlike his previous marriage with Lita, where he kept her on a tight budget, Suki could spend as much as she wanted.
Well, yeah, that was before Bissell sucked up all his money.
Yeah, well, after that, he started counting every penny. I mean, every single penny. He kept a day planner. He tracked Suki's movements. He wrote down who she met whenever she goes out. He would write down where she would go and how much gas she would burn. He got angry when she would run the air conditioning. And he was also on her about the toilet. He says that she flushes the toilet too much. And at this point, Suki, she started thinking, maybe I'm making a mistake marrying Jim.
Well, yeah, because she didn't marry for love. She married for money and the lifestyle. Plus, she probably wanted to flush her toilet.
So Suki, she is tired of the constant complaining about spending. She's tired of Jim chasing her around with the American Express bill, waving it in the air to make her feel guilty about all the money that she's spending. So they start arguing. The neighbors can hear them yelling, and Suki quickly realizes that she needs to make a decision, stay with this mean control freak who nitpicks at every little thing she does, or get away. The choice was easy for her. So Jim, he puts the mansion on the market at $3.9 million, but later he increases the price to nearly $5 million.
Well, hopefully he flushed the toilets before they showed the house.
As far as the Florida State's attorney's office, they had not forgotten about the traffic ticket and the lie that both Jim and Suki told. So one day, while Jim was out playing tennis, the cops come and arrest Suki. They charge her with perjury. The newspaper headline of Suki's arrest reads, "Palm Beach socialite Suki Sullivan, wife of the town's Landmarks Preservation Commission chairman, was arrested and charged with lying to a judge." The arrest pushes Suki over the edge. She didn't do anything. She was trying to be helpful to her husband. But after all that had happened since Jim lost that $1.5 million and the way he's been cruelly mistreating her, Suki doesn't see a reason to cover up for him anymore. She starts crying and she tells the officers everything. Later that night, police officials release her when Jim pays a $10,000 bond. Suki was glad to be out of jail, but she was anxious and scared. She broke out in shingles. That night, she pleaded with Jim to tell her why he forced her to lie about being the driver in court. In response, he brings his finger up to his lips to signal Suki to quiet down. Then he closes the door and turns up the TV. He has Suki sit next to him on the couch, and he tells her, "Anyone could be listening at any time. You need to understand. If I go to jail, I might never get out. Let's sell the house as soon as possible. We can go anywhere you want, any place in the world."
Okay, but he didn't answer her question at all.
About a week after that conversation, on June 13th of 1990, if Palm Beach Post readers looked at the bottom half of the front page, they would have found out that Jim Sullivan was divorcing his third wife after almost 2 years and 9 months of marriage.
Honestly, I'm surprised he didn't try to kill Suki, too, because she's the co-owner of the mansion, and we know what happens when you get between Jim and his money. For instance, he killed Lita, and she was barely going to get anything from him.
Yeah.
I mean, in this case, he's going to lose millions of dollars, potentially.
Yeah, maybe he didn't want it to be too coincidental that his wives seemed to be dying.
Agreed.
But their divorce was still pretty rocky. So when Suki filed for divorce, she wrote, quote, "My husband follows me about, watches my every move, and makes me account to him for every moment of my life. He calls me foul names. A year ago, he told me that I was dealing with a dangerous man," meaning him, "and that I had better watch out. He throws things at me. His previous wife was murdered in Atlanta. His behavior is so aberrant and threatening to me. Albeit he has not hurt me physically, he has left me in a highly nervous state and very scared," unquote. The divorce was contentious, but from the start, the judge said there would be no questions or discussion regarding Lita's murder. He pointed out Lita's case had nothing to do with this divorce case. Yet during her divorce trial, Suki Sullivan testified that Jim Sullivan confessed to hiring someone to murder his previous wife, Lita McClinton. She recounted that after Jim paid her $10,000 bond, he closed the door, turned up the TV volume to prevent anyone from overhearing, and admitted to hiring a person to kill Lita. And Suki was feeling like he would go after her next.
Okay, so she did know what he was capable of. So she has every right to fear this guy.
Oh, yeah. And the Atlanta police, they did hear what she said. They were watching the trial. And soon they'd be having her testify, too. As for the divorce, on December 10th, 1990, the judge ruled mostly in Jim's favor. Suki was able to keep her $42,000 engagement ring, her wedding band, a Cartier bracelet, a suitcase filled with pantyhose. But not much else. Jim kept Lita's old car, the deed to the house, and Coco, the Maltese Terrier. But remember that traffic ticket for the expired tags and driving with a suspension? That was still going on. The following day, Jim appeared in traffic court, and he pled no contest, which he probably should have done right from the beginning. The judge sentenced Jim to 90 days of house arrest and 6 months of probation. But the house arrest is not really punishment when he's allowed to work on the weekends.
What does he even do for a job? I thought he sold his business.
Well, he doesn't have a job, which is why the house arrest is not really much of any kind of disciplinary action. If you look at his 1989 tax returns, he lists himself as being retired. He's also no longer on the Palm Beach Landmarks Preservation Commission. His divorce from Suki received so much negative publicity that the commission voted him out. So he usually played tennis and showed up at parties, but when he left the parties to go home, he usually arrived much later than the instructed curfew time.
This guy just still feels like he's above the law.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. In March of 1991, Jim pleaded no contest to perjury charges. And as a result, the judge sentenced him to an additional year of probation and a year in jail. However, his attorney successfully negotiated for house arrest in place of jail time, though with stricter conditions. Jim was required to wear an ankle monitor, refrain from drinking alcohol, and remain indoors at night. Court officials also restricted his movements within his mansion, confining him to the ground floor. He was only permitted to leave for business meetings on weekdays between 9 a.m. and 7 p.m., and even then, he had to follow strict protocols, calling before departure and again upon arrival at his destination.
I still don't get the business meeting limitations because he wasn't even working. He wasn't even on the board of that committee anymore. So, like, what were these meetings that he was allowed to attend?
Yeah, it's kind of weird because he really shouldn't have qualified as a person who had a job. Because in order to qualify as someone who had a job, the sheriff's office actually sends out a letter to the employer informing the employer that the detainee is under arrest and must notify the sheriff's office if the detainee is late for work or leaves early. So Jim provided a piece of paper to the sheriff's office, which named him as the president of Progressive Funding, a financial services company. If the sheriff's office deputies had done their due diligence, they would have discovered that Lita is the co-director of Progressive Funding and that the company closed in 1982. But even with the designation of being a detainee with a job, Jim was still very limited in where he could go.
This kind of reminds me of, I had a friend who went to jail for something that was like stupid, like painting a football field or something. And his dad owned a business, but would let him do work release, but he would just come home and play World of Warcraft for hours.
He might have been doing that. Who knows?
Maybe.
So years have passed, but the Atlanta police have not forgotten about the case. They're still working on it. Then on September 5th, there was another break. Remember Marvin Marble, Poppy's ex-husband? Police still suspect him of having taken part in the killing. He agreed to talk to the police in return for immunity. While Marvin gave police plenty of information, he made sure not to give police any information that incriminated him. Years may have passed, but the Atlanta police have not forgotten about this case. They're still working on it. Then on September 5th, there was another break. Remember Marvin Marble, Poppy's ex-husband? Police still suspected him of having taken part in the killing. He agreed to talk to the police in return for immunity. While Marvin gave the police plenty of information, he made sure not to give police any information that incriminated him. So, as you can see, things are starting to fall apart for Jim Sullivan, who at a time had everything, wealth, status, and influence. In part three, we will reveal Marvin's shocking testimony and the critical breakthroughs that led investigators to Jim Sullivan. So next week, we will discuss how the police pursued Jim across the world, determined to bring him back to face the consequences of his actions. And now with the walls closing in, the question remains, what evidence will they uncover to finally solve this case?
It's got a Carmen Sandiego vibe for sure.
Shut up. So you won't want to miss what happens next. Be sure to subscribe to Crime Salad to get notified when your Crime Salad episode is ready.
Where in the world is Carmen Sandiego?
Also, consider becoming a patron or an Apple subscriber to avoid the ads. We love you. Stay safe, and we'll be back next week.